Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up on the TaxCast later, sun, sea and tax. We look at how multinational tourism operates in developing economies, and it's not a pretty picture. But first, here's the Tax Justice news headlines for this month. 9 banks accused of rigging foreign exchange rates are paying out $2 billion in settlements to US investors who lost out. So a few more parking tickets for the banking community. I'm sure they won't do it again. Now here's a question for you. Would you fancy approving Europe's largest open-pit cyanide mine in your country? Well, the Romanian government didn't think it was a good idea and they tried to stop it going ahead. Now, obviously, the Canadian mining company were pretty unhappy about that, and they're now suing the Romanian government. They may even try to claim up to $4 billion in compensation from the country if the mine doesn't happen. Just to put that into context, that's about 50% of the country's entire spend on public health each year. Now, the interesting thing also is that the mining company Gabriel Resources is using a subsidiary company registered in the UK Crown Dependency Haven of Jersey, which campaigners believe is a shell company of convenience, because that company's base in Jersey means the mining company can use corporate law based on a bilateral trade deal between the UK and Romania. Campaigners are calling on the British Prime Minister to stop these kind of shell companies or mailbox companies being used by companies who've got no real business in those jurisdictions. We'll have more on that one as it develops. Assessing God's bank for transparency. Pope Francis has made the most serious moves ever to tackle long-standing rampant corruption in the Vatican Bank, otherwise known as the Institute for Religious Works. The Tax Justice Network's asking if they'll put their money where their mouth is and agree to being assessed for the Financial Secrecy Index, so we can all see how transparent they're really becoming. The latest Financial Secrecy Index will be out in November this year. And finally, here's one to watch, the use of offshore jurisdictions by Sharia banks and other forms of Islamic finance is on the increase. In recent years, there's been a scramble to become Sharia compliant, and among the most popular at the moment are the Cayman Islands, Jersey, Bermuda and the British Virgin Islands. Two newcomers in this arena are named by the Gulf Times as Mauritius and the Seychelles. Those are the Tax Justice headlines for this month. Now we're going to talk to the Tax Justice Network Director, John Christensen, for his take on this month. OK, John, let's start with Brazil. The government there is looking to get back some of the $150 billion worth of assets Brazilians are estimated to be holding offshore in secret bank accounts and tax havens. And they're offering an amnesty from prosecution if they disclose where they got the money from and they pay a 35% penalty. And that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because this contrasts quite sharply with tax amnesties elsewhere in the world, doesn't it? Because if you look at Italy, for example, they offered their tax evaders a one-off tax of 5% on the assets they declared.
Well, that's right. The big story here, of course, is that the Brazilian government is facing a huge fiscal deficit. The economy is likely to be going into quite a severe recession, and they need the money. And that's the background to this. So the question is, will this amnesty work? Now, if you look at other amnesties, some have partially worked. For example, Italy's had some success in recent years. But the Italian tax amnesty, which took place in 2010, attracted back fairly large sums of money because it offered a relatively low one-off tax rate of 5% on the assets. It's a wealth tax. And that was quite successful. Argentina, on the other hand, hasn't been so successful. Since 2013, they've offered a tax amnesty, but they were placing quite a high level of tax on it. And Argentinian wealth holders were concerned that they couldn't trust that the government would keep it part of the bargain. So the Argentinian amnesty hasn't been so successful. As you say here, in the Brazilian case, what they're offering is, first of all, that the wealth holders, people who's holding their wealth in tax havens, must come back. They must disclose the wealth and they must disclose how they got hold of that wealth in the first place. But they must also pay a 35% penalty on it. And some Brazilians are saying that penalty is too high to actually make it attractive to Brazilian users of tax havens to bring the money back. So I think it's a case of watch this space. Tax amnesties in the past, generally speaking, haven't worked, because what happens is very often the governments offer a very low rate of penalty and a very low rate of tax to attract the money back. And it does attract a fair amount of money back, but then it goes offshore again almost immediately afterwards. Whether that happens this time round is a moot point, because, as I said earlier, we're moving into a new world of greater transparency, greater information exchange. The attractions of using offshore are greatly diminished as a result.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in Brazil with this amnesty, because it seems to me what the Brazilian government is doing here is right, really. This is a proper amnesty. I mean, these people have been evading tax. Presumably, they knew what they were doing. They were not contributing to their own society, their own country, to the services that the country needs. And Brazil really needs that money. It seems like a real amnesty, a proper amnesty, how amnesties should be, really.
Yes, I agree. I'm not personally in favour of amnesties. I think they aren't necessarily the best policy tool. I think the best policy tool, frankly, is to rigorously chase tax evaders. And where they investigate and successfully prosecute, I think that has a really strong deterrent effect. So I think it's far better actually to go for some fairly high-profile prosecutions of tax evaders, because that encourages all the rest to come forward and confess their sins.
OK, so we'll be interested to see how that goes in Brazil. Moving on then, we've got some more bad press for the pariah state of Luxembourg, which is apparently awash with euro notes. They're printing them like there's no tomorrow, apparently. What is the story here?
Yeah, well, we know and love Luxembourg, of course, as one of the most prominent tax havens in the world, soaking in huge amounts of savings from some of its neighbouring countries like Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, France, and so on. What's been happening is that there has been a really significant increase in recent years in the issuing of large euro notes. By large euro notes, I'm talking about 500 euro notes. Now, I don't know how often our listeners actually see a 500 euro note being offered in a shop. It certainly doesn't happen very much around the shops I've been visiting. In 2013, Luxembourg's central bank issued 15% more euro notes. And if we look elsewhere, for example, in Italy or in France, there's been a drop in that period. So what is happening? Well, one explanation is that all those Germans, Belgians, French people who have been holding accounts in Luxembourg in the last few decades are getting frightened about the prospect of their accounts being revealed under automatic information exchange processes, and they're busy pulling that money out of Luxembourg by withdrawing it in the form of 500 euro bills. And the thing about 500 euro bills is they are a convenient way of holding large amounts of money. If you hold them in smaller denominations like 10 euro notes or 20 euro notes, that actually takes up a large amount of space. But 500 euro notes are very portable and are easily stored away in a small safe or something like that. So that's probably what's happening. I think the bigger picture here is that for a long time, for decades in fact, holding cash in big bill form, like a 500 euro note, is very convenient for money launderers. And big central banks, particularly the US Treasury, and more recently the European Central Bank, are only too happy for people to hold this money and stockpile it under their beds or in their safes or wherever they hold it, because they actually are earning implicit interest from people holding that money. They're very happy to have that cash sitting out there doing nothing. And the truth of the matter is that money, by and large, isn't actually circulating within the economy. It is largely being held under the bed. So that's probably the real story. Luxembourg is issuing these big bills so that its clients from other countries can withdraw the money and hold it in big bills, which they store in safes or under the bed or wherever they want to put it.
And you can check out the TaxCast, edition 32 of the TaxCast, on how Western banks and treasuries are facilitating crime through high denomination bills. So have a listen to that. Right, so let's look at the United States then. There's some comments from the US economist Joseph Stiglitz. He says that the United States has become an obstacle to reforming international laws on tax, debt and finance. And we talked last month about how the US and the UK and other OECD countries were blocking progress on reform of the international tax system in the Addis Ababa summit recently, where there was a meeting of governments and all their finance people.
Yes, well, Joseph Stiglitz, of course, was a member of the Independent Commission for the Reform of International Corporation Tax. Now, what was on the table at the Addis summit was a proposal to move into a new era where taxing rights are aligned with the economic substance. In other words, multinational corporations would be taxed on their profits according to where the profits are genuinely generated. In line with the way the US actually internally taxes multinational companies at state level. That was what was proposed, but that was what the US and its allies have firmly rejected. And at the same time, they rejected the proposal to upgrade the United Nations Tax Committee to a full-blown political committee, which would create a truly global forum for discussing and agreeing on mechanisms for cooperating on international tax matters. Whilst the US and its allies might have won at that particular moment, they might have prevailed, they bullied other countries into agreeing to stay with the existing arrangements where the OECD countries are effectively controlling the rulemaking processes. Stiglitz argues they're on the wrong side of history. And I think he's absolutely right. Since the Bretton Woods settlement in 1944, which came into effect in 1946, they've dominated the global institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, and the OECD has dominated the process of setting the rules in tax matters. But I believe the days in which the Washington consensus prevailed and the neoliberal agenda was forced upon other countries across the world, those days are past. Neoliberalism has failed. We're moving into a new era. And what the US, UK, and others are trying to do is they're trying to prop up the old order in order to hold their power in place. They're annoying the rest of the world. China, India, Brazil, and others can see this isn't working for them because the rest of the world increasingly sees the US and UK as gaming the system to benefit their companies and themselves.
I wonder how long it's going to take there. I mean, how long will it be before these countries, the poorer countries and those left out of the OECD process, the countries that are getting the bad end of the deal, how many more meetings do you think there are going to be where these countries are bullied or cajoled and who knows what happens behind closed doors before they actually insist on an empowered UN tax committee?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. I think 2015 is a really important year in that respect because the OECD is coming forward imminently, you know, within the next few weeks, with their BEPS proposals. And the rest of the world is looking very, very carefully at BEPS. So BEPS is the base erosion profit shifting process, which the OECD launched in 2013. What they're trying to do through a 15-point action plan is to rebuild the processes, the rules for taxing multinational companies around the arm's length method, which the OECD has enforced for several decades, but which, as many of us know, has proven to be unworkable. At the moment, what we're seeing coming out of the OECD is a huge increase in the complexity of the rules with very little sign that they will actually improve things, particularly for poorer countries. If BEPS doesn't give the rest of the world at least some of what they want, if not all of what they want, then they are increasingly going to say, well, this isn't working for us. We must move to a system that works for us. And we're already seeing new regional banks emerge, which are not controlled under the World Bank process. China's moving forward with that project. Latin America doing the same. Gradually, you're seeing the political power of the old West diminish. I think the next 10 years is going to be fascinating as we watch the end of that epoch, at the end of the Washington Consensus and the emergence of a new world order, in which hopefully the United States, United Kingdom and their OECD allies will not be able to bully their way to rig the rules in their favour.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. The summer holiday season is upon us, but did you know that tax-dodging multinational companies dominate the tourism market so much it's almost impossible to avoid using them? This month, the TaxCast goes to Mexico to investigate sun, sea and tax. Tourism's one of Mexico's top industries, and Cancun is the country's most popular international tourism destination. You'd think that'd be good news for the state of Quintana Roo and its citizens, but recently Cancun declared itself bankrupt.
Mexico not only has magnificent beaches, but also excellent food, archaeological sites, world-class diving, traditional handicrafts, and much, much more. It is these attractions that add the value, and yet as little as 20% of the package price arrives in these economies to pay for them. The amount of tax loss is enormous.
This is Linda Ambrosi, chartered accountant and author of a brand new book, Sun and Sea Tourism, Fantasy and Finance of the All-Inclusive Industry. According to her research, the tourism sector's a real playground for multinational corporate tax avoidance, particularly in developing country economies.
Little or no taxes that are paid in the countries where the value is added to maintain these very attractions. In the case of tourism especially, companies and politicians trot out GDP activity and employment, both of which these numbers are farcical. You can easily have GDP growth alongside increased impoverishment called immiserizing growth. GDP growth does not reduce wealth concentration.
Right, and they're very powerful, aren't they, these companies?
Extremely powerful. In fact, they're bigger than the nations that they work in.
And you've looked at some huge companies which really dominate the market. And as with most multinational corporations, it's not easy to unravel how they work. And as you point out, you shouldn't have to have a PhD in accounting as you do to be able to figure out what's going on in terms of taxes they've actually paid. And if we take the example of just one of these companies, TUI AG, a holding company headquartered in Hanover, I mean, it's got 677 direct and indirect subsidiaries. 47 of them are based in Germany. There's 630 in other countries. They've got 22 affiliated companies and 40 joint ventures. And because of the way their accounts have been done, they're set to pay no taxes anywhere in the world until 2020. Now, for a destination like Cancun, you found tax havens like Delaware and the Cayman Islands were quite often key to the operations of various companies there.
It's far less transparent than products, I would say. It is complicated to disentangle the brands and the beneficial owners. And so it's really interesting that reservation centers in the United States, from where the money was channeled to the Caymans. Because the activity does not occur in the United States, the American authorities do not care about the money siphoned to the tax havens. And the Mexican authorities cannot know what amount was paid for the reservation in the United States and subsequently invoiced between these superficially independent companies for the services that they are offered in Mexico. In the case of an all-inclusive, this means that outside your vacation destination, the company has already received all the money for international travel, ground transportation, lodging, food, drinks, and entertainment. That means the company to which you paid determines exactly how much enters the destination, which is often a developing economy.
You might think if you're an independent traveller and you don't go for all-inclusive deals or what we might call package holidays in the UK, you're not giving these companies your custom. But they've pretty much got a grip on every area of travel worldwide. So that's from flights to hotels to tickets for events, entertainment and special tours. So you'd probably be wrong. Linda Ambrosi.
It's extremely hard to avoid them. And that's not even the point. The point is not even to avoid them. It's to make them pay at the destinations where the value is being added.
So if the bulk of the money's not even getting to these tourism destinations, where is it actually going?
It would appear offshore, but this is the other thing, that they're the tax havens that are fully declared or fingers are pointed at them by a lot of international agencies. And then there's others that have tax haven characteristics, but for various political reasons are not indicated as tax havens. The biggest one that I found for most of these tourism companies was Holland. because many of these companies use dividends and they use back-to-back interest operations. And by channeling through Holland, they're easier to transfer the money back within the European Union without paying taxes. So Holland was a key for, I found, for the hotels. What I found for airlines, the key is Ireland. The third in the United States is Delaware. But what the United States has started, which is something very specific to these hotels, because they are real estate investment trusts, what they call REITs.
As TaxCast listeners know, companies can get up to all kinds of mischief using trusts. And of course, lack of transparency and tax minimisation is common in many multinational business models. But the resulting tax losses in Mexico are harder to bear than in wealthier countries. And lost tax revenue is on the increase in Cancun.
In Mexico, the combined income tax and value-added tax provide 80% of Mexico's non-petroleum government revenues. Cancun, in the 1990s, used to generate more federal taxes than it absorbed in social programs and local budgets. By 2007, the last year the data was available, Cancun cost the federal government more than $700 per person over and above the federal taxes that are collected locally. I was able, as part of my doctoral dissertation, I collected all of the public finances for Cancun from its inception in 1984 when they started producing numbers to right to the current date, to 2012, 2013. As of 2007, that was the last year the data was available, but if I extended what is a perfectly correlated curve, Cancun right now is costing over $1,000 per person, per resident, in excess of what this region collects in all important federal taxes. And again, this is not about a current business model. It's also about the lack of political will to change it.
Right, and there's a reason why you've only got the stats up till 2007, isn't there?
Unfortunately, for whatever reason, in 2007, Mexico decided that the breakdown of federal taxes by state was considered private information. And for that reason, not even through transparency laws have we been able to get the current numbers to date. And for that reason, I only have the numbers until 2007. It's important to stress that this anti-competitive behavior and tax dodging is often in collusion with local authorities. The more corrupt the local authorities, the more prevalent these elements.
So why has the tax take gone down so dramatically? Well, it seems one of the reasons is that in Cancun, it used to be the case that only the hotel room itself was paid for outside Mexico, and everything else was paid for and declared locally, so food, drinks, entertainment and tours. But now that all-inclusives dominate the market, tourists buy the whole lot outside Mexico. There's a negative effect on two fronts.
So not only do you have these large corporations that pretty well locally declare no profits because of the way they transfer money in, so they keep their corporate income tax, or that what should be paid as corporate income tax, outside the country and reinvest it here. But more than that, when you suffocate the local industries, those are the people who pay VAT. So If you're not getting corporate income taxes, you're also not getting the indirect taxes of value-added taxes, which are also an extremely important part of any federal budget. Local restaurants and tour companies are at a huge disadvantage. Just to give you some figures here in Cancun, in 2000, okay, in 15 years ago, only one in every three rooms in Cancun was all-inclusive. It is now three out of every four, or four out of every five rooms now in Cancun is an all-inclusive. And the amount of rooms available in Cancun has increased by 30% in the same period. So Cancun now has 28,000 rooms, of which anywhere from 75 to 80% are all-inclusive. So let me just read something from my book about some of the really important statistics of how the local economy has changed because of their influx. This onslaught of foreign-owned all-inclusives in Cancun reduced the once-thriving zone of domestically-owned shops, restaurants, and nightclubs to a near ghost town. In 1997, 78.3% of Cancun tourists ate at restaurants outside their hotel. By 2011, the number fell to 38.2%. In 1997, 77% visited malls and stores outside their hotels. By 2010, the number fell to 56%. For local businesses to receive coveted tourists, the all-inclusive hotels sometimes demand a 40 to 50% commission on the price of the tour excursion or spa treatment. They can also demand up to $100 from restaurants to recommend them to hotel guests. The local restaurant Chamber of Commerce is calling for controls on all-inclusives. Meanwhile, a group of foreign-controlled local tour operators, including Amstar, which is Apple Vacations from the United States, Viajes Caribe Maya, which is Oasis from Spain, Hotel Beds, which is TUI Germany, Riu Spain, Vacaciones Barcelo, which is also from Spain, seeks to weaken the Chamber of Commerce.
And as we've also seen so many times before, tax minimization strategies so often go hand in hand with poor employee rights and prospects.
Studies have shown that all-inclusives hire 25% fewer personnel than regular hotels. So hotels and room numbers grow while employment and wealth stagnates or concentrates in the hands of a few. The employees also here in Mexico, and from what I'm understanding, this is becoming a common practice in many other countries, are hired by an outsourcing company, never directly by the hotel or by the operations, and certainly not by the company that owns the assets. That company may or may not be directly attached to the hotel. So here in Mexico, especially Cancun, these employees are laid off at a maximum every 3 months. Some of them, I have some examples of where they're laid off every month to avoid labor obligations. Also, it allows the hotel to lower their staff numbers in low seasons such as May and September. Then they are rehired just before high season. Not only do these employees never accumulate health and housing benefits, many are forced into illegal activities to survive. Robberies in Cancun peak in October and November just before high season. Security is fundamental to a vibrant sun and sea tourism industry. However, the same all-inclusive hotels often use and abuse the insecurity image to keep tourists in the hotel and purchasing services only through them, further concentrating revenue and control.
Right. But it doesn't have to be this way, though, does it?
I suggest in my book that tax departments need to conduct their own value-added analysis of this tourism. In the book, I reference several sources of how to do just that. Tax administrations need to assess the value added and not simply the profits or losses declared, and then look at ways to tax appropriately. For example, what would it be to tax directly every tourist that's on the beach a $1 bracelet to use the Cancun beaches, and that money goes directly to the Environmental Protection Agency, specifically for the beaches? So there's a lot of ways that you could use targeted taxes with independent board of directors to make sure that that money is properly used and funded. Incentive. Let's say working with local communities, if you can offset it doing environmental protection, that would be great. To make sure that the beaches are maintained, to make sure that the turtles are protected, to make sure that the coral reefs aren't bleaching, that would be wonderful. But again, all of that is based on first making an accurate calculation of how much they owe locally.
The very fact that one of the most lucrative tourism destinations in the world has declared itself bankrupt tells us something's very wrong. We know we've got a global problem in terms of multinational tax avoidance, but there are many ways that developing economies can take control without waiting for international agreement to stop abusive practices like the ones we've been looking at. Among other tactics, applying a tax to so-called deemed profits has worked well in situations where there's not much prospect of accessing the statistics on the genuine economic activity by companies. Also, adding very specific anti-abuse clauses in tax legislation can work well. Check out the Tax Justice Network's senior advisor Christian Mehta's list of 10 ways developing countries can take control of their own destinies. You can hear him talk about that back in edition 19 of the TaxCast. And to find out more about Linda Ambrose's book out this month, Sun and Sea Tourism, go to www.tourismfantasyandfinance.org. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.